The method.
Ideas. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Hello and welcome to Unsound Methods with me, Lachlan Bloom.
And me, Jamie Batchin. If this is your first time listening to Unsound Methods, this is a podcast where we speak to other writers of literary fiction about their craft, approach and technique.
And in this episode, which is episode 47, we're speaking to Sam Byers. And we're coming to you slightly late this week, but we're all alive and doing well.
I survived the second bout of COVID in about 4 months, which was good. But we delayed it by a week to put it out. We're now recording this intro in the middle of, I think, the third storm in about 4 days. So very much out of the frying pan.
Yeah. Hopefully this reaches you for the 23rd when it should come out.
Fingers crossed. And if you're listening to this, when you do eventually get power and 4G restored, I hope you're having a lovely summer. So Sam Byers is our guest for episode 47 of Unsound Methods.
And yeah, we had a great chat with Sam at the end of last year, talking about his writing process. We delved into the fact that he keeps a journal with each project, or he writes a journal alongside each project, that he kind of puts some of the thoughts that critical thoughts or other thoughts around the work into the journal, and that helps sort of drive on the momentum of writing the work itself. So we discussed how those two relate and how that informs his process overall.
Yeah, just a little bit of background about Sam before our conversation. He is the author of Idiopathy, which came out in 2013, Perfidious Albion, which came out in 2018, and Come Join Our Disease, his most recent novel, which is probably the one we talk about most in this chat. I thought we would start, as we often do, just asking what a typical writing day looks like for you at the moment, perhaps.
I suppose it depends what stage of a book I'm at. So at the moment and for the foreseeable future, I'm in like the sort of creation stage. So pretty much everything I'm doing now is new material. And so for me, that's really just about getting up and getting on with it, really. I like to try and write quite quickly in the first stage and then edit very slowly. So I find, you know, as early as possible and as undistracted as possible, the best for writing new material from scratch, just sort of generating material. I'm not very concerned in the early stages about whether it's good or whether it's right or anything like that. I just want to have something to work with, and I want to have as much to work with as possible. That sort of becomes my routine, really. And I try and do my writing before I do anything else. But later on, when I've perhaps got a full draft, or I've got a bit stuck, or I'm moving into more sort of editing frame of mind, then I sometimes like to sort of approach that a bit later, and it that does feel more like sort of work. So I suppose there's a sort of almost an unconscious phase that I quite enjoy, and then a very conscious, you know, much more meticulous editing phase, which is often longer than the writing phase. So at the moment, it's really, I mean, I wouldn't say chaotic, but it's really just about having lots of material. And then I prefer to think later about what I want to keep and what I want to use and how I want it to be. So that's where I am now.
Do you have a sort of defined start to that creation period? Is there sort of a conscious decision to start the unconscious period, so to speak? Or do you just sort of find that you're in the midst of making notes and writing things down?
Yeah, I think there comes a point where there's nothing you can do sort of but start on something. So There is a sort of phase when I finish a book when I'm maybe not thinking. I try not to think too hard about what I'm going to do next. I, you know, give my mind a bit of a break. But often there's usually something simmering away. And then there will be a phase of sort of making notes and reading things. And I really like the idea of I've heard it described as sort of putting things in the box. So like you have a big imaginary box of things that are that might be relevant. Again, I try not to think too hard about what's relevant or what's essential. So there is a sort of phase of just sort of metaphorically flinging things in the box, thinking, oh, that looks interesting, or that piece of music is the right kind of mood, or that's something I want to follow up on. And then there comes a point, I suppose, where you feel like there's nothing more to be achieved through doing that. You know, the thing is asking to be written. And I don't think particularly well when I'm not writing. I can have sort of loose ideas, but really all of my thinking happens while I'm working. So there's only really so far I can get with notes and, you know, possibilities and bits and pieces. You know, at some point, if I'm going to really try and make something work, then I just have to start it. But I think the secret to that for me is, again, not, I don't sort of fixate on whether I'm starting in the right place or whether it's good or whether I'll be keeping it. I probably won't be keeping it. I mean, the vast majority of early work doesn't tend to make the cut in the end. So I'm used to that and I'm comfortable with it. And there is also, I suppose there's a degree, there's a slight convenience factor as well, where you think, is this the right week to start what is potentially a 3 or 4 year project? And, you know, sometimes the answer is no, mate. Maybe we better start it next week, you know. So, yeah, a bit of thought goes into that. Like, maybe sometimes I want to sort of, there's often a bit of a process of sort of clearing the decks. I often have a big scrabble of like getting lots of chores done, clearing some emails I'm supposed to do, finishing up some other bits of work. And then I like to start in a really sort of like with a totally clear desk and then try and maintain that as far as possible through the rest of the project.
When you start that, you've got the boxes full, so to speak, or it's as full as you want it to be. And are you going back and pulling things out of the box, or do you just keep the lid shut in the box and you're happy that you've been through the process of filling it and you write unfiltered by the notes or whatever is in the box?
That's a good question, actually. It's a bit of both. I remember reading Toni Morrison saying that, like, the best way of reading as a writer was, you know, without taking any notes and just trusting that it was all going in there. I do have a lot of faith that everything I sort of consume and expose myself to is going in there somewhere, even if I don't have particularly good recall. Like, I'm not someone who can effortlessly quote works that I've read, or, you know, like, I just don't have a good head for that kind of memory. But I do have a lot of faith in what's sort of bubbling away in there. But what I do find quite useful is if I've gone a bit astray or got a bit stuck, or, you know, I'm trying to think what needs to happen next, then it can be quite useful just to go back to all of the stuff that you were using to get yourself started and remind yourself and be like, oh, you know, those were some interesting ideas I had 6 months ago. That can really sort of get you back in that place again, I think. And so I know it's always there. But much of it probably, like, there's been times when I've looked back over my notes when I've finished a book and just been like, wow, you know, I didn't use any of that. Those are all good ideas, but, you know, they just didn't come to anything.
Can you still trace a sort of through line back when you look at them, even though you haven't used them consciously? Can you see what they sort of started to shape from those notes?
Definitely. It's usually more thematic. Like, I can see that I was sort of circling. You know, my favourite feeling with a novel is if there's sort of 3 or 4 ideas or themes and they're sort of circling and informing each other. And so I can usually see that I've been picking up on things. I can see what they were related to. And sometimes I can remember exactly why I didn't do something as well. Like, I can remember trying something and it just being clear that I wasn't going to be able to do it in the way that I wanted to do it. So I can remember what happened to that, like, particular idea or thread. And sometimes I think, oh, you know, rats, like, if only I'd looked back at that, you know, when I was halfway through the book instead of when I'd finished, you know, that would have been really good. And then some of those things go into other projects. Like, I've had stuff in the box that has come out again for another book. And that's, again, sort of fine. I trust that it's all in there somewhere and coming to something in its own way.
Do you actually sort of segment in terms of box, this is the box for this book, and it's an actual separate either physical notebooks or separate folders on your laptop or computer? If you're stuck writing something and you think, oh, I'll maybe go and look back at some notes, get some ideas. Do you constrain yourself to just look at the notes that you did for this project, or is it just sort of notes in general and you might spend the morning looking back at various different things and hit on something that from a note 6 years ago?
No, it's quite specific. It's literally like, say, in the notes app or whatever, it's labeled with what that particular project is. And even within that, it might be divided up by characters, or it might be divided up by certain sort of themes or ideas.
Are you quite meticulous then? And when you're making a note, you're meticulous to sort of categorize it and label it before you start putting the note down?
Yeah, it all sort of goes in a folder. And so I know that I could find it if I wanted to. Like I say, often I don't, although I am relatively meticulous about finding things again, I find that I don't actually look for them again. But I also keep a written journal that I write in every day, which is less ideas and notes and bits of information and more me sort of interrogating the tech, more me sort of talking to myself, if that makes sense. And because I do that every day, that's quite repetitive. I mean, some days I might be addressing the same issue again and again and again in my journals. And so then that is very much sort of ingrained in there at that point. And I think it's quite interesting. I think, you know, it's quite a good way of thinking about starting a novel, is to see what you forget and what you don't forget. I think it can be useful to allow certain ideas and images to, you know, impose themselves in a useful way. So if something like survives that slightly chaotic process of being in a folder, being in a journal, getting forgotten, getting missed, etc., etc., if that's still sort of nagging at your brain naturally, then I pay quite close attention to that. You know, I think it's very interesting if I can say to myself, well, it's been a year and you're still thinking about that.
Do you have a particular style or format for the journal that's distinct from your notes? If someone were to read the journal over all the entries for a year, would each entry follow a kind of form or style, or are they quite different? One day it's bullet points, the next it's sort of prose, the next day it's a dialogue imagined with someone? Or
I try and just write an uninterrupted page in my journal. So they're just dated at the top and they're not really paragraphed. You know, I try and just, that is a place to put sort of raw thoughts really. And they're often, it's often where I put what I might call sort of thoughts of sabotage. So it's quite a good place to put like sort of negative feelings about what you're working on. Like that would be where I wrote, you know, this isn't working because of X, Y, and Z, or this is too like this, it's not enough like that, or know that I've drifted off into doing too much of this like easy thing that I know I can do when really what I want to be doing is this. And so that's a way of sort of interrogating myself and nudging myself a little bit and, you know, exposing, sort of in a sort of very controlled way, exposing the text to critique. You know, again, because I don't always think very well off the page, it's just a way of sort of formalizing that process. So I'm still thinking while I'm writing, but in a different place. And I don't want any of those sort of thoughts creeping into the writing itself. So I find it really useful to have that notebook as a completely separate space, and it's handwritten. So like it's away from the computer where I do my actual writing. And so, yeah, it's good. It's good to sort of keep that as like a place to say anything, really. But if you read it through, it would just be, it would be incredibly boring, because it's often for days on end me like chewing over the same problem, like, you know, why can't I make it more like this, or, you know, why can't I find a way of doing this, you know. And so there's not really, I just think it would seem very repetitive, you know. You'd end up being like, why can't he answer his own question? why doesn't he know?
It sounds quite focused on the work then, rather than a sort of journal of I went to the shops today and COVID again and that sort of thing. Have you always done that, or was that something you've introduced at some point in response to like a difficulty with that piece of work?
It sort of evolved. When I wrote my first novel, Idiopathy, I didn't keep a journal. I started to keep a journal, I think, when I'd finished that book, because I was thinking about the next book. And then Perfidious Albion became so sort of complicated and included so many different things that the journaling became quite important, just to sort of stay on top of everything I was trying to think about. And part of the experiment of that book was almost to sort of be dealing with some things almost not quite in real time, but sort of close to real time. And so journaling was quite significant in order to kind of just keep all of those things live. But then I just found it a really useful habit. And, you know, it has stuck, and now probably write my journal, even if I haven't done any writing that day. And it's just a good place to, it's a bit less intimidating than the blank page of Word software or something like that. It doesn't really feel like you're writing. It just feels like you're noodling about, and that can be, I think that can be really, really sort of helpful.
It's not something I do, but the thought of writing self-criticism about your writing seems so much easier than starting the writing yourself.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, sometimes, you know, on a difficult day, sometimes all you need to do is just sort of get going, you know. And again, the journal is quite helpful for that. And when I'm really in a good flow, it all links together, because I do some writing and then I do my journal in the afternoon or evening, and then I go to sleep. And then when I get up in the morning, I've already like done my thinking the day before. I know what I need to work on this morning. And then like it all just has like a nice sort of, it never really feels like I'm starting cold, if you know what I mean. Whereas if I have a few days off, then it's like you're revving back up again. You've sort of got to get back in the headspace. And
do you limit yourself to one page in the journal? Like, do you some days go over that and you've written, written 20 pages today? Or?
Yeah, I think when it's particularly knotty or particularly in the earlier stages of a novel, there's a lot more ideas. You know, by the time you're in the sort of back third of a novel, you don't really want to be having new ideas. Like, that's not time to be putting new stuff into the book. You should really be tying up the ideas you've already had. So I think if you went back through the journals, you'd find that there were pages and pages in the early stages of a novel of like, oh, and I can include this, and I'll remember to include that, and actually later on this can happen, you know, all of this sort of stuff. And by the end, it's much more like just try and keep going, try and finish
get
it
to the end.
You know, I don't think that's a great time for new information, really.
Is it fairly linear, and like the writing, you sort of write line by line as prose, or is it some days it's a page of doodles and like notes and bullet points and squiggles and arrows and mind maps? Or
it depends on the book. Like, I don't do any sort of, like, I'm not particularly a visual person, so I like working with just prose. Like, for me, it's easier just to write a whole big chunk of stuff that I then get rid of than it is to try and sort of mind map it out or something, because I can figure out how I want it to be while I'm doing it. And often it's just a stray line or something that makes me think, oh, that's how to do it. And, you know, I think you could probably tell the difference if you read the books as well. Like, Perfidious Albion wasn't written chronologically. I use Scrivener to write, and it has this really helpful feature down the side where you can just make loads and loads and loads of sections. And I would just keep creating different bits and snippets and shuffling them about until it started to make sense. Whereas Come Join Our Disease, which is all in the first person and a very, very linear narrative, I just wrote straight through, no sort of interruptions or faffing about. I think I moved very little in that book. It was more about getting the voice right. And, you know, what I'm working on now is probably somewhere between the two of those things. I do think it's easier to work chronologically if you can, but I also think, you know, if you haven't got any ideas for the bit you're supposed to be working on, and you've got a really good idea for a bit that comes 100 pages later, you might as well get that down rather than do nothing, rather than just wait a year to be able to write that scene or something. It's better sometimes just to do it and park it. So yeah, I'm not sort of wedded to working chronologically, but you can, I think, in a big novel, get yourself into a real mess if you're just writing any old place every day. Yes, you know, at some point that's going to catch up with you, and you're going to have a big edit job on your hands to put it all together.
I guess that slightly depends on how much planning you do beforehand, because we have spoken to some people who have a real sort of modular version of the plot worked out already, that they know the sort of capsules of each bit, so then it would be easier to jump around. But if you have a vague destination, that's where I think, yeah, you're gonna screw yourself up.
Yeah, I don't have any, like, there's no big wall of post-it notes or what I've found. I mean, I do in my head know sort of roughly where I'm heading, or at least a little way forward, But what I've found is if I'm too meticulous in my planning, if I've got this big list of scenes to write, I immediately become very bored because they all just feel like homework. So instead of getting up in the morning and having this sort of exciting sense of like, oh, what's going to happen today? Like, you know, what am I going to work on? Like, what am I going to discover? I just have this sense of like, oh, I've got to write scene 23A this morning. And I find that very dull. I find it like sort of being at work. Yeah, I mean, that probably means my books aren't as tightly structured as some, but I hope instead they sort of retain like a, you know, a bit of energy or a bit of sort of life about them. But it's certainly very important for me to feel like I can surprise myself and I don't completely know what I'm doing and there's still a sense of possibility. And I try and hold on to that sense of possibility for as long through the book as I possibly can until it's really like, okay, but you know, you do have to tie up some of these threads.
Do you find you have to balance between that sort of forward momentum and sort of course correction at all along the way? I'm thinking more like you're saying Come Join Our Disease a lot more chronological and you wrote it more, you know, from beginning to end. Did you find you'd sort of write something one day and then coming back to it the next day, you thought, actually, no, maybe I need to backtrack, delete that whole section and start again from where I was 2 days ago? Or do you, while you were writing the first draft, was it just, well, that I know that section's a bit wonky, but on to the next bit. And once I get to the end of the draft, I'm going to come back and tweak those bits I'm unhappy with.
Yeah, I try to go as far as possible without reading back over what I've got or worrying about. And some things I know as I'm putting them in there that they're really just a sort of placeholder for how it will be. Mm. You know, like I'll go back and do it better. But what I do find is often around the 100 page mark, and then certainly again about halfway through, there just comes a point where I can't continue without printing off everything I've got and having a look at it and like ordering it a little bit and thinking, oh, hang on, like, you know, where do I need to go from here? And so, yeah, several times through the course of a whole novel, I'll just hit print on the whole document and spend a week reading it with a pen in my hand and thinking, right, like what's keepable, you know, what's worth developing, what's not worth developing, you know, what's working. Mm-hmm. And often, again, I mean, speaking about surprise, like it's often surprising, you know, your reactions to some of that reading back. You know, often things you thought you'd done well, you read it back and think, ah, no, actually, you know, that doesn't work at all. And things where you thought, well, that's just sort of rough, I'll sort it out later, I often read it back and think, oh, actually, you know, that's quite good. I prefer that to the more sort of thought through stuff. So I think by retaining that sense of like not focusing too much on whether you like stuff while you're doing it, you leave yourself more open down the line to including stuff that's a bit more surprising, or, you know, just reading your work in a slightly more open way.
Do you find you cut quite a lot or change quite a lot at that stage? Or is it more sort of, oh, maybe change this word here and there and cut a sentence? It's not sort of, I had 40,000 words and I'm now down to 20,000 and carry on from there.
It's the latter first. So like first, I mean, my feeling about editing is you can't fix everything in one pass. I know that I'll do like, I don't know, 20 passes. So the first time reading something is really quite big picture. And it's just like, keep that bit, don't keep that bit, do that bit completely differently, move that over there. And with each pass, it should get more and more sort of fine grain. So in theory, by the last read through, I'm down to like, is this a comma or a full stop? Or is, you know, but I don't want to get too tangled up in all that stuff early on, because I think it's quite easy to, I think it's something I often see in sort of writers who are starting out, or, you know, writers who are sort of finding what they want to do, is it's very easy to become quite fixated on the sentence level and try and make every sentence really, really good without sort of, you know, really tackling some of the bigger picture, you know, structural stuff. So my personal feeling is that you can always smooth out the prose. That is always very doable. And I actually really enjoy that stage as well. So it sort of helps me not get tired to save that stage up and you know, still have that to look forward to. But I think if you really get too involved in the fine detail stuff too early, it can lead to a bit of paralysis, because you're endlessly searching for the perfect way to write this or that line, but you're not making much sort of forward progress. So again, I'd much rather have a big pile of like 200 really bad, really rough pages in front of me than one really perfect page, but then like no idea what to do.
You said earlier about the voice being really important in Come Join Us Ears, and I was interested in that and the tone as well. And I have a subsequent question related to this. So firstly, I'd ask, is that in the note phase that you were really coming up with that, the sort of feel, the atmosphere of it and the character before you started writing, or did that develop just from the scenario that you were dealing with?
Yeah, a lot in the sort of note phase, which often, like I use music quite a lot sometimes. Well, with every book really, you know, it's not always very easy to describe how you want something to feel. And so sometimes it can be useful to use different artworks, like artworks from different disciplines, to sort of express that for you. So maybe music, or, you know, I know other writers who use the visual arts a lot to just as a way of not defining, but giving some sense of the more sort of tonal or intangible aspects of a piece. But in terms of the voice, I can only really figure that out by writing. Like that is just sort of trial and error. I have a sense of sort of how I want it to sound, but you don't know until you write something whether it is going to sound like that. And what I always think is most things can be adjusted in the editing process. You know, if a scene is in the wrong place or it doesn't quite work, it's not a big problem. You know, you can do it again. But if the voice is wrong, the only option would be to write it all again. And so the early phases of a novel are often just the voice is the sort of key focus, really, and getting that right. Because I think if you start off on the wrong foot with the wrong voice or the wrong tone, and you haven't quite got that right, then that's not fixable by just shuffling some sentences around. You'd have to take a whole different approach. And so with Come Join Our Disease, there were more than with the other novels. There were more sort of false starts and early pages and just trying to figure out sort of how she spoke. And once something like that clicks, although it can feel, it's a bit of a drag at first when you are trying to get it right, when it does click, I think the rest of the novel actually goes much more quickly, because you know you can dial into that voice and you know roughly how to approach things. So it can be a really, really useful thing to get right. But it was also unusual because that's the first book I've written in the first person. So there was a technical challenge there as well. Like I was shifting out of my comfort zone of like omniscient third person and, you know, really tackling the first person, which I think in some ways is more difficult prospect. I know first person tends to be slightly more popular. I think lots of people go for the first person. I do think there are sort of technical aspects to it that are very challenging. And so I gave quite a lot of attention to that as well. Like, you know, you can't do all the sort of easy stuff you do with plot in the first person. You can't just like jump to another character and be like, oh, you know, now this scene's happening, you know, across town or whatever. So it does require a bit more thought, I think.
I begin at the beginning. I write my name on the first page. I write my name, and then I write the title. Then I write my name. Then I turn over and I write the title of the book. I write chapter one, and then I write on. And when it's, I leave a space so I can make alterations as I go along, but I don't revise it afterwards. And then it goes to the typist, and she types it, and I revise that, and that's the book. That's finished.
What led to that decision then? Did you start writing in the first person, just became obvious that that was the point of view, or did you decide that you wanted to just try writing with a different point of view?
I think more and more I'm interested in, you know, not really being present in my writing. The writing I like best is when I can't sort of see myself in it or hear myself in it. You know, it was natural to start to gravitate towards a fictional first person. I think allowed me to take that sort of further step away from, you know, my own tastes, my own way of thinking, my own way of doing things, and, you know, inhabiting someone else who is obviously clearly still, that still comes from me. But I think it was a useful way of stepping into slightly new territory. And I also think, you know, emotionally, Come Join Our Diseases, I think a slightly more emotionally complex novel than Perfidious Albion. And I'd wanted to get at slightly more difficult subjects, I think. And so the intimacy of the first person seemed a better way of doing that. I think the subject matter of that book, you know, particularly some of the sort of middle and later passages in that book, which are quite sort of repellent, and also where you're perhaps sort of questioning the mind state of the narrator. If it was done in third person, I think it would be easy for a sense of judgment to creep into that third person voice, where if it's just kept in the first person, you never really know to what extent Maya is totally in control of the things that she's doing.
You mentioned the where it becomes quite repellent later on. I'm sort of interested in that because I've seen you say elsewhere that you had handed in the final draft of it in March 2020, just before we entered a global pandemic, which I assume listeners will have heard of. Do you feel that that had a kind of impact on your mindset, that you'd been conjuring up a very repellent atmosphere for this or necessity of the story, and then we were thrown into a situation where we were kind of encouraged to see other people as being kind of potentially diseased and to be avoided? Do you think that, having just finished the novel at that point, you'd kind of stitch yourself up a bit for the real world?
Yeah, I mean, it was certainly odd, although at the time I sent off the last draft of the book, it was literally the first week of lockdown. And so, you know, I have to confess to a sort of certain amount of naivety about lockdown. You know, I have a day job as well as being a writer, and me and colleagues were still at that point saying, like, we thought it'd be 2 or 3 weeks and then, you know, probably be able to get back to the office again. So although it was weird, the full weirdness of lockdown had not yet become clear. You know, it had not yet become clear that this would be really the next 2 years of our life, and that, you know, we would enter very sort of complex territory indeed. So it was more actually when proofs of the novel started going out and I started hearing from people who'd read it, you know, like, I hadn't remembered things like there's a scene where they spit on someone and, you know, tell him that they're sort of infected with some horrible disease in order to sort of repel his advances. You know, things like that, I hadn't made the connection with the world we then lived in. So it was more about having some of that stuff reflected back to me that was odd later on. And of course, by then I did have a much clearer sense of lockdown. But I suppose the other thing to say is some of the things lockdown revealed to us, which are sort of significant in the book as well, like our attitudes to work, for example, or, you know, whether or not we want to spend our lives commuting and working to the point of exhaustion. Those were kind of simmering away in the culture before the pandemic, and then the pandemic very much sort of brought them to the surface. So quite a lot, I think, of what came out of lockdown and came out of our experience, our collective experience of the pandemic, was more about having to confront things we'd maybe slightly put off thinking about for, you know, many, many years before.
But with themes like that, is that, would you sort of consciously write notes prior to starting work on Come Join Our Disease Day? Are those sort of themes, is it at that sort of level you're thinking about things, or are those sort of emerge naturally because you're thinking about the world we live in and those themes are part of the world?
Yeah, I think they emerge just from sort of trying to pay attention to society and, you know, what seem to be the sort of, what I see as some of the sort of driving issues in the world we live in. I try and pay attention to that. I try and at least pull some of my inspiration from that experience of the world. And, you know, it was the same with Perfidious Albion. That was a much more overt attempt to kind of like reckon with some of the forces that I felt were shaping society.
Mm. And would that appear in the journal that as you're doing your daily journal, you might have a day where your journal entry is about the issue of commuting, say, or, you know, an issue of that sort of conceptual nature, and you write specifically about that? Or is it more nebulous within the work, that you'll be, the journal will be about how do I tackle this problem with a character, and through thinking about that, you introduce something about commuting, and then that becomes part of the story?
I think that's more nebulous. Like, I'd be very resistant in my journal to sort of feeling too much that I was writing, like, or here are my thoughts and observations on this particular phenomenon. You know, that makes me feel sort of self-conscious. I might write about my, you know, own experience of something and think, oh, you know, that's interesting, maybe there's something there. But I think what's also going on with some of those observations is, you know, once you're in the character and you're in the character's life, you're starting to think about how they would experience the world. And so actually you're almost looking for opportunities to show what's happening in their interior life through some sort of external event. So say you wanted to make a point about the way work renders our life very routine, or sort of circumscribes our day or our experience of time or something like that. The commute is a very obvious place to begin, you know, so immediately I would think, well, that's quite rich. There's quite a lot that you can do there without having to write some sort of like essay in the novel about, like, or how, you know, you like how you feel that, you know, every day is sort of routinized. And I also think one of the easiest ways of doing character is just to have the character moving around in the world. It sounds very obvious, but, you know, you get to know characters in books really through their interaction with other people or aspects of the world, unless it's a very sort of insular, internalized novel. So again, I sort of feel like, particularly when you're working in the first person, you know, if you're not careful, you could just end up with a book that is like just someone speaking all their thoughts, which I'm not averse to, but I'm not skilled enough to probably make interesting enough for people to read it. So you're always sort of thinking, like, where can I put this character? Like, where can I make them go to? What can I make them encounter? Which then is like, becomes an opportunity for getting what I really want to get at, which is their inner state and their like emotional and psychological life.
In terms of the voice off the character, when you, I mean, I guess more so in the first person approach, do you find you need to read out loud to sort of see, you've printed 100 pages at the start, and is the first thing you do read those out loud, or is it more a case of reading mentally and then making notes?
It's slightly difficult to describe, but if I could put it as like reading it out loud in my head, if that makes sense. So I don't want to hear it in my voice. Like, that's the last thing I want to hear. I'm trying really to sort of get rid of my voice, so that's not helpful, just to put it back in my voice again. But I think there's a way of reading it to myself in my head that sort of does sort of emphasize, you know, as if it was being read out loud, but perhaps not by me. And I think that's important in terms of, I find rhythm very important in prose. Like, the prose I like to read, not even just the prose I like to write, but when I read something and think, oh, that's, you know, really good prose, it's often a rhythmic element. Like, it's often a writer who I think has a really strong sense of rhythm and has really paid attention to kind of sentence length and paragraph length, and is doing something interesting with that. So I think there is a way of reading in my head that is emphasizes rhythm. But again, I think that's a job for later on as well, when I'm more in that sort of fine grain phase of editing, you know, that we were talking about earlier. I think earlier on I don't even really need to read it like that. It's much more just like a very sort of instinctual feeling of like, this is a good bit, this is a terrible bit. Just sort of clear away all the stuff I'm not keeping. And then I can start to think about like how to really, you know, make each passage how I want it to be. But yeah, there's a way of hearing it internally, I suppose, is the best way I could put it.
Yeah. I mean, would that go as far as sort of having a regional accent? If a character has a regional accent, having that mentally in your head, or is it not as much of a performance in your head as sort of putting different accents on characters?
Yeah, I'm cautious about accents. I try and do them in as subtle a way as possible. And I think also often the dialogue in my books is quite stylized. So it's not always as if I'm straining for realism in that sense. Anyway, I think particularly comic dialogue, like if you want to do a scene that you know you hope is funny and has a certain kind of comic timing, then you're often leaning quite hard away from ultra realistic dialogue into a much more sort of snappy, staccato like way of rendering dialogue that approximates the way people might speak to each other, but isn't actually really how people would have a conversation in real life. So I think dialogue in that sense, it needs to work on the page for me more than it works read out loud. And, you know, there are some writers where, you know, who I push that even further. You know, think of a writer like Don DeLillo, whose dialogue I think can become incredibly stylized to the point where it's difficult to imagine people actually saying what he's put in their mouths. But that's because I don't think he's straining for realism in those passages. He's doing something else. So yeah, it's not, but equally, if it was important that someone was from a certain place or a certain background or spoke in a certain way, I would be at pains to get that right. I think the worst thing you can do is sort of make a sort of half-assed effort at defining the way someone speaks and then not quite get it right. I think that always leaps off the page for me. And so, yeah, I am careful, but that's often more about trying to hear in my head the way someone I'm thinking of would speak. And I think that's the easiest way for me to sort of bring different voices into the text is to use people I've met and spoken with where I feel like I can sort of call up their voice a little bit rather than trying to generate that from scratch. But again, I wouldn't read that to myself because that would then just be my voice again, and that's not helpful.
I think it's an interesting point with the dialogue, I think, in terms of that is sort of a continuum, isn't there, between the realistic end of dialogue and that sort of very sort of abstract. You almost can get to the stage where it is two characters having a conversation, but it's also just a very abstract string of words. When you're at that end, it can do a lot of things that it's completely impossible to do when you're trying to be realistic to the way people speak. There's so much in when you actually concentrate and writing. It seems that, like, initially when you start writing, you think, oh, the thing to do is just listen carefully to what people say and then approximate that. But the more you listen to the way people actually speak, the more you realize it's quite crazy. And
yeah, it's often chaos. And
Donald Trump in, you know, in the press when he was president, it was invariably quoted with non sequitur, total nonsense. But so many people speak in maybe not on the themes that he talked about, but in the phrasing and mm-hmm. the structuring of natural language, it doesn't flow like it does on a page in a book quite often. And I mean, there's good and bad to that, I guess.
And it doesn't. I think dialogue between people, you know, in real life doesn't behave in the way that dialogue behaves on the page. So, you know, you read quite a lot of sort of dialogue that wants to be very, very realistic. But the difficulty is it can only be, you know, because the way that dialogue is laid out on the page, it can only ever be sort of more mannered and more to and fro than would ever be the case in real life, where people sort of interrupt each other and talk over each other and misunderstand each other and miss the point. Like, you know, something I think that's a constant risk in fiction is that, you know, because you want the dialogue to flow well and, you know, be quite concise, you end up with characters that just understand each other too much. You know, end up with dialogue where everyone just magically totally gets what the other person is saying and there are no misunderstandings or mishearings or complications or confusions, which actually is, for most of us, the sort of, that is the bulk of our communication day to day, is sort of struggling to make ourselves understood, struggling to make ourselves heard, or going back and thinking, no, you know, that's not quite what I mean. But then you could reach a sort of extreme of realism in trying to render that just made it sort of unreadable. So it's a very difficult balance, I think, and different writers place themselves in different places along the spectrum. I mean, something I'm quite conscious of is I'm either sort of doing dialogue or I'm doing prose. Like if I'm in a dialogue-y bit, I often tend to dial the prose right out and just let the dialogue run. And equally, I'm not afraid to have, I think some writers would certainly say, look, you can't just have 10 pages of prose with no dialogue in it. I remember like people have said to me, like, oh, well, you know, readers will just stop reading, you know, because there's no, whereas I feel like that can be really interesting. I'm happy to do that. And I'm happy to have 10 pages of dialogue with no, you know, interruptions of prose in it as well. So I think that's slightly, that means the dialogue has to do a little bit more work in my book sometimes, because I'm not interjecting as much as I could.
I think it's that balance between the sort of the amount of prose to dialogue is, I think, something that it varies from project to project, I feel, but it's something it's can be at the forefront of readers and as a writer as well, at the forefront of your mind from time to time. But I think sticking to anything too concretely, it makes things too rigid. It's also interesting that, like you were saying about the way that it's consumed on the page, that dialogue, even if it's trying to be realistic, there is a sort of feel like the difference in the sort of temporal way that natural conversation flows and it's gone. I mean, we're speaking on a podcast which is recorded and it's not gone. Hopefully we can play it back, but the sense is that you or the person you're conversing with say the words and they're gone, whereas on the page there's a spatial element to it. Then character A says something here, character B says something on the line after, and it stays like that forever. It's fixed in that relationship, whereas as you're speaking you kind of, you don't retain everything that the either you or the other person has said. Things kind of disappear from your memory, and you might be able to recall later on, but as you're in the process of speaking, there's a different sense than the sort of timelessness of a dialogue on the page that you feel isn't going to change.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And I think it can lead to a situation where people speak in novels in a way that is just too definitive. You know, like they're almost speaking as if they know that what they say will be accessed many times, you know, from here on in. So it has to be really right. You know, so they're expressing themselves in this very definitive way, which is, sure, that's true for some people. You know, that's just how they're able to speak. Some people are very good talkers, but a lot of people just, you know, wouldn't be able to sort of be that considered in what they're saying, and that certain in what they're saying, and much more hesitant, and they're much more sort of going around the houses, and they're speaking in a way that almost depends on being forgotten, you know, which is what you're addressing. You know, they're not attaching so much significance to their own speech because they experience it as ephemeral. And so I think, you know, we always have to be careful as novelists not to afford our characters, you know, too much self-awareness in that sense. And in the same sense of, you know, we all, when we speak, you know, like reveal ourselves accidentally, you know, much of what we say isn't what we meant to say, but it does say something about us. And it can be very hard to capture that in fiction, I think, because it can just look too obvious, or it can just, you know, look too considered or a bit too neat. So I think those are like really difficult things to address in fiction. I think it's why I hear lots of people who are starting out writing say that they find dialogue a very difficult thing to get right. And I think those are all reasons why, you know, you might read your dialogue back and just think, for some reason, this isn't quite how I want it to be.
Do you find the voice, finding the voice and finding the sort of ratio of prose to dialogue, or finding the sort of entry point into dialogue, or how do you sort of balance those things, the voice and the where they speak, where they choose to speak? Are those, for me, it kind of feels like those are this part of the same thing, but do you find they sort of develop, you kind of get a hang of the voice from the dialogue you're writing more than the prose? Or
no, I mean, my starting point is always prose. So, you know, if I just sat down and started writing, it would be prose. And then there are points where I feel clearly some, you know, scenes have to happen and people have to encounter each other. And I think what I find more difficult is I'm relatively content to write a scene where people are just sort of talking to each other. Like, that, you know, they're just chatting. Like, that's okay. I think what's really difficult are those scenes where people are talking to each other and that scene has to do narrative work, you know, so isn't, they can't just have a chat. Like, there's stuff that actually needs to be said or needs to be imparted. So you're getting into the difficult territory of sort of like expository dialogue that I always think is really, I struggle with it, not just in my own work, but when I read other novels as well, or, you know, when I watch films, you know, where you just think that has not been particularly skillfully done. That to me is often a real sticking point. And it feels like that is where it's hardest sometimes to suspend your disbelief. And so finding ways around that, I think, is very, very challenging. Those are always, I think, the toughest bits of books. I'm much happier just in the looser sections of books where it feels more exploratory and, you know, I'm dealing more with someone's inner life, and it's more sort of, there's a sense of sort of curiosity and exploration there, rather than when I'm getting stuck in, you know, stuff that quote unquote has to happen.
I think there's an element that the reader generally is, there's a lot more scrutiny as well. And in the conversation, and whether it's trying to expose a plot point or move things forward in some way or not, the reader is, their ears are pricked up looking for significant data within that, in the way that you wouldn't necessarily be in the real world in a conversation. You're not normally sort of primed to expect that something might be revealed through a conversation, in the same way that reading a novel, you're kind of half expecting or hoping that something will be revealed, and that will shift the novel or move things forward in some sort of way.
Yeah, quite. And it reminds you that the vast majority of dialogue in our daily lives isn't there to impart information. It's there for the sort of pleasure of speaking. So, you know, if you live with your family, or, you know, you go to work and you speak to your colleagues and you're all sort of chatting, that's not actually about imparting information a lot of the time. It's not about clarifying anything, or it's about the pleasure of company and, you know, the pleasure of conversation. If anything, you're often sort of looking for things to talk about, you know, just so that you can be talking or listening to someone else talk. So again, that's quite difficult to convey in fiction, where there is this feeling that like talking means something, and what people say means something, and there has to be a reason the reader is reading it. That, I think, is quite difficult. And, you know, I notice it in film and television as well. You know, like, it takes quite a brave writer, I think, to fill time with people talking as they would just actually talk to each other in daily life.
So thank you for listening. That was Sam Byers, and we hope you enjoyed that show. Do remember to like, subscribe, share with your friends. And you can find us online at unsignedmethods.co.uk, and do check out some of our previous back catalogue of guests. We've had some great chats over the last four years. You can also find us on Twitter at Unsigned Methods, or you can find me and my writing at LachlanBloom.com, or I'm on Twitter at Lachlan.
Yeah, and thanks to Sam for joining us. His website is sambyers.co.uk. We'll put that in the episode notes that you'll see just below this. And if you're interested in finding out more about me and my writing, I'm at Jamie Batchen on Twitter, at Jamie_Batchen on Instagram, and my website is jamiebatchen.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you all next month.